There's a kind of fiction that we all subscribe to, that journalists and broadcasters in particular don't have any personal views. And of course, we all do.
The Profile with Premier Christianity Magazine.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Premier Christian Radio. I'm Sam Hales, editor of Premier Christianity Magazine. That is the magazine that sponsors this show. And every single week, we bring you a new guest right here on The Profile. I'm delighted to say that my guest today is Edward Sturton. Edward is a broadcaster and journalist with a career spanning 40 years. In that time, he's worked on factual programs across BBC, radio and television, often specializing in religious affairs. He's the author of a number of books, and his latest is Sunday, a history of religious affairs through 50 years of conversations and controversies. It's a look back through the archives of Sunday, a program broadcast on BBC Radio 4. Edward, welcome to the show.
Very kind of you to have me, and thank you for that very generous introduction. It always makes me feel very ancient when I being reminded that I've been doing this stuff for 40 years.
Yes, indeed, you have. Experience, an experienced journalist. I always think experience sounds better than veteran, because I think that does then make people sound old, doesn't it?
No, you're right. And experience, I think, is incredibly important. You sort of hope you have learned something in all that time of being on the air, learned a few lessons.
Absolutely.
Still made lots of mistakes, but I hope we've learned a few things.
Absolutely. Well, we're looking forward to hearing some of those stories, but we want to go right back to the beginning to start off with. Can you tell me a little bit about what your memories are of childhood growing up?
Well, I had a very unusual childhood, really. I was born in Nigeria. My family moved all over the place. We were in Malta. We spent many years in Switzerland. And then during my teenage years, I was at boarding school in England, but we lived in Ghana, in West Africa. Which was just an incredibly privileged way to grow up, partly because they're fun places and interesting places, but also I think because it gave you a kind of sense of the wider world. And coming back to England was supposed to be coming home, but didn't really feel like it. You know, home was everywhere. And in fact, you know, somewhere like Switzerland, lots of people from this country would go there for their holidays. So we were really very lucky in that way.
And I understand you were educated at a Roman Catholic school. So how important was faith for your parents and for you growing up?
Well, my father he died a couple of years ago, a serious Catholic, a traditional Catholic. My mum is still alive, is an Anglican. And it was, I suppose, when I was really becoming conscious of religion, it was in the years after the Second Vatican Council, which, as you remember, was that great kind of reforming meeting in Rome in the 1960s. So there was lots of chat about things like the Latin Mass, which was restricted at that time. And people like my father took a rather dim view of that. But it was certainly, in traditional terms, a very observant Catholic childhood. You know, we went to church every Sunday. We observed family fast days and holidays and obligation and so forth. And the education I had, which was first at a Catholic preparatory school in Sussex, and then at Ampleforth, the monastic school in North Yorkshire, obviously built very much on that. And in a funny sort of way, I mean, it's a very strange thing to say this now or to reflect on this now, but my family were Catholic during the Reformation and remained Catholic despite Henry VIII and, you know, Elizabeth and all that. And weirdly, I think that still cast rather a shadow over religion when I was a child. So, for example, at my prep school, all the dormitories were named after people who died hideous deaths at the hands of the English state. You know, people like Thomas More, who was executed at the Tower, or Edmund Campion, a Jesuit who sneaked into Britain and during the years when Catholicism was prohibited, and he was hanged, drawn, and quartered in this grisly way. So it's a very odd way of, you know, you grow up with these martyrs of an earlier time, very much held up as examples of fidelity and courage And it gives you a slightly old sort of feeling about being British in a funny sort of way, because obviously it's a prep school and you're very brought up as a Brit. But at the same time, these examples of people who were very much at odds with England as it then was, and I think that was, I don't think my children had that at all, but my generation very much did.
Yeah, and looking back at that childhood, that upbringing, was there a moment where, or a series of moments where you felt like your faith was becoming your own and it was more than just your parents, but it had greater meaning, I suppose, for yourself? Because I know a lot of people I speak to, certainly as teenagers, will often kind of walk away from the faith they've been brought up in completely. You know, what was your experience? How did you realize that Catholicism was not just something your parents did, but it was actually something meaningful and special for you?
I think if you grow up in a Catholic community like Ampleforth, it kind of seeps into your being. There was remarkably little rebellion, which is odd if you think that this was the 1970s during that period. The monks, I mean, it's awful to reflect on some of the stuff that's come out about Ampleforth since then. But at the time, I think we rather respected and liked the monks. They'd made this huge sacrifice to serve God. They were intelligent. It was a very liberal environment. And I think it wasn't really until I left and went to university that I sort of became conscious that the whole world wasn't like this. And for quite a lot of people, being Catholic was weird. And actually, monks are even weirder. So I don't think I would say there was a moment at which I consciously made a choice like that. I think it was just became part of who I was. And I think it's remained like that ever since. It's just there, if you like. And I don't think, and I never felt any particular, I mean, of course, I, you know, like everybody, I've had ups and downs in my degree of my faith and the degree to which I observe it. And certainly when I went to university, I wasn't quite so good about going to Mass. And even and quite often now I fail. But I don't think I ever thought of a sort of decisive moment in which I had to choose, really. Mm. It's just kind of there and it's always been there.
Is there a sense then that actually the faith of your childhood and the faith of today are actually quite similar?
Yes and no is the answer to that. Yes, in the sense that it's kind of there as a constant thing, but I think one's understanding of it, I hope, has changed and deepened over the years. Partly actually because of my work. I mean, I've traveled a lot in the course of my work. And in the late 1990s, I did a BBC Two series on the Catholic Church across the world. And we amazing sort of budget in those days. I don't know if you'd get that now, but we traveled everywhere, Latin America, India, Africa, Rome, obviously, the United States, various countries in Europe. And what I came to realize is that Catholicism is something much bigger than the sometimes rather narrow way we see it in Europe and in Britain in particular. It's not just about sex, which is sometimes, you know, you sometimes feel it is listening to the European church. It's about issues that are really pressing in those wider parts of the world. Poverty, social justice, education, all those things are much higher up the agenda. And that's I found that very kind of revitalizing and made me realize that there was more to my faith than I thought previously. So I hope it's a slightly more sophisticated, more thoughtful thing than it was when I was a child. But you're right, yeah. It's a kind of basic assumption that there it is, and you know, I'm comfortable with it. It's the same.
It's really interesting what you just said there about this kind of assumption that the Catholic Church or Christians in general are obsessed with sex, because I've heard that accusation leveled at the church. I've also heard it leveled at the media, that actually this isn't that Christians are obsessed with it. It's that journalists want to keep asking about it. I mean, you straddle those two worlds as a journalist and as a Catholic. Where does the truth lie?
I have to say, I don't think my journalism has focused very much on sex.
I'll give you an example. The Church of England Synod has met and they've discussed 101 different issues, and all of the headlines will be about what the Church of England thinks about same-sex relationships.
But isn't that because they have been, and I, you know, doing this book, I certainly noticed that they have been obsessing about that subject for generations. And I think that's, you know, that's driven our concern to cover it in that way, because the church itself is so divided about it, has been so focused on it. Same with ordination to women. You know, you're probably going to say to me that means we ignore uncontroversial good things that the church does. And I think there's an element of truth in that, of course. But, you know, well, for example, we're talking just after the dreadful events in Israel, and preparing for next week's program, we are looking for either Anglican or Catholic Palestinian Christians to talk, you know, voices you haven't yet heard. And that, you know, that's an entirely positive way of affecting the church's mission. So I wouldn't apologize for the amount of attention we've given to things like the church's position on same-sex relationship, because I think we are faithfully reflecting the nature of the debate in the church. And as I said, I don't think it's fair to say that we wholly ignore the church's more positive contributions. So I think I'll defend my profession on that front. I mean, you know, it's the same with abuse. You know, I got miserable for a while presenting the Sunday program. It's sort of the period, the end of the first decade of this millennium, when every Sunday I would turn up and it would be another dreadful story of abuse, very often involving the Catholic Church, particularly the Church in Ireland. But goodness, we had to cover those stories. Of course we did. Incredibly important, however uncomfortable it may be.
Let's go back to the beginning of your career. What made you want to pursue journalism as a profession?
I did a lot of it at university. I also did a certain amount of public speaking at university, which I enjoyed, and I realized I could do it with reasonable confidence. And I suppose I wanted to be engaged in big public issues, really. There's probably a bit of ego in there too, pleasure in the sound of my own voice. You know, the pleasure of being out on telly, as it was in my sort of first job. But I think it's really the privilege of being there when history is being made, and also of being able to find stuff out. It's just a, you know, and sorry, I'm being practically inarticulate in answer to this question, but also the process of continuing to learn. I mean, I very much enjoyed learning stuff at the school and university, and journalism gives you a chance to go on doing that. You know, I quite often find myself somewhere, particularly on foreign stories, thinking, goodness me, I'm being paid to do this, and I really enjoy it. I do it for free. When you're discovering a new culture or a whole new political system, or you're meeting some really unusual and articulate person, it's a great job.
You were talking there about the privilege it is of finding things out and working as a journalist and really uncovering the biggest issues of the day. Is it fair to say that religion is often at the heart of the biggest issues of the day, but perhaps that isn't always recognised to the extent that it should be?
Absolutely. I mean, that's why I think that something like the Sunday programme is such a wonderful institution, because it's one of the few places that does give religion the serious treatment that it deserves. And I think not only are we a very secular country, the media are very secular-minded too. And I think that blinds us to the religious dimension to stories very often. And it means we get them wrong. And actually, since we are talking after the dreadful events in Israel, it's worth reflecting on the rise of Hamas, which began as a religious movement, as an offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. And I think unless you understand its religious roots and understand the way those were transformed into essentially a military philosophy and what's behind all that, you just aren't going to understand what they're all about, which you need to, obviously. So I think secular journalism very, very often misses that dimension.
It's really interesting you raise that, because that was one of the things I wanted to ask you about. As you say, we are recording shortly after the news from Israel, where Hamas have gone in, infiltrated and killed hundreds of people. And actually, the reports coming out of the region right now are so horrific. I can't even give some of the details on air. And I wanted to ask you about that, specifically about Hamas, because actually those of us who have an interest in religion, it's not like it's a secret. It's that actually these groups are very open about their religious and theological motivations. But I think you're right. In a lot of the kind of secular media coverage, that is often glossed over. And there is a fundamental religious motivation to these groups. But it seems perhaps difficult for us sometimes in the West to talk about that and to bring religion into the picture. Why do you think that's the case?
I think it's because we are such a secular society. And you know, it doesn't for me, doesn't fit with our world view. Whereas, in fact, we are the odd ones out in this small corner, this small secular corner of Northwest Europe. For most of the people on this planet, religion remains an enormously important, you know, motivating factor. But it's a kind of failure of imagination, I think. You know, that we don't understand it because it's not like us.
It strikes me how things have changed, because in the introduction to your book, you note the kind of really the Christian foundations of the BBC. So, for example, in the 1920s, there was no broadcasting at all on Sunday mornings in order to observe the Sabbath. And the BBC handbook at the time said, quote, "The BBC is doing the best of service to prevent any decay of Christianity in a nominally Christian country." Reading that today, I can think of many, many Christians who would love that to still be the case, for the BBC today to say, we want to prevent the decay of Christianity in this country. But of course, you and I know that is absolutely not how the BBC sees things. And so actually, there's been a huge amount of change.
Well, it has. And to be honest, it shouldn't be the BBC's job, that I don't think. Rees had an incredibly powerful influence on the genes of the institution. And I think it's amazing how long that kind of basic idea that it was the BBC's job to promote Christianity went on. If you think that in the 1960s, almost all the staff in the religion department were ordained clergymen in the Church of England, which is an astonishing fact, really, if you think back, isn't it? But actually, the foundation of the Sunday programme was a decisive moment in all that, I think, because that was the first time that religion had been treated as a legitimate object of journalistic inquiry, not just worship, not just the celebration of religion, but a rigorous judgment of religious institutions in the way that journalists would make them about political institutions, almost. In the early days of the program, Anglicanism, the Church of England, remained very much its focus. But that, of course, has changed hugely too, as perhaps the place of the Church of England in the nation's life has diminished somewhat, and also as religion of other kinds has become so important both in Britain, but also, as we were discussing earlier, around the world. So I think Lord Rees, I think he died in the year that Sunday was established. So he probably wouldn't have approved at all, but it is a very, very different world. And I think rightly so. I mean, the idea that we should proselytize a single religion in circumstances where the Church of England has become so much less of a force among the population as a whole, where our religious landscape has become so richly diverse, where, you know, other religions have such a big sort of place in our society today, it would just be wrong for us to go on doing as you say, or doing as John Rees said in that BBC handbook.
Yes. you mentioned we live in a increasingly secular world, secular society. How do you deal with the objection from an atheist who might look at you and say, "Well, Edward, you've had this incredible career. You bring this journalistic integrity and this inquiring mind, and you're a thinker. How can you personally believe in the what an atheist disparagingly would call the kind of sky fairies and that kind of attitude that just sees religion as clearly made up nonsense? We have no evidence for it. You know, how do you personally respond to that kind of an accusation?"
Well, I don't feel that personally I need to, is the answer to that. There's a kind of fiction that we all subscribe to, that journalists and broadcasters in particular don't have any personal views. And of course, we all do. We obviously can't say which political party we either, well, we can't allow to belong to them, but we might vote for, because that would lay us open to accusations of bias. And I think, although we can say what religion we are, there's some of that sense of distance applies with religion too, in that what I want to be judged by is what I do on air, what I say and the questions I ask. And if somebody can look at a program I've done and said, "We could tell that you were a Catholic from the way, you know, say you address the issue of abortion or the death penalty," then I would be failing in my job, and then I absolutely would have to answer that question. But touch wood, that hasn't happened yet. And I think after a while, we talked about experience and so forth, after a while, the habit of keeping your views to yourself and asking questions in a way that is neutral and impartial and doesn't betray a personal passion or a personal opinion, that just becomes rather like religion, anyway. That becomes part of who you are. So that would be my answer to your notional atheist who might put that question. You know, okay, only a fair enough question if you can point to occasions when you've been sitting in the kitchen and you start throwing things at the radio because you think I'm asking Catholic questions. If I'm not, if I'm asking the sort of questions that you want answered, then we're all fine.
And I can well understand how professionally that's the answer. Professionally, once you are in front of that microphone, being a journalist, asking those questions, your personal beliefs don't come into it. You're there to do a job. But if you're not behind the microphone, if you just bump into someone in the pub, do those sorts of impartiality questions still run through you? Are you still reluctant to kind of give too much of a personal religious response because you're aware you represent the BBC, or there's a bit more latitude there?
I think that, to be absolutely honest in answer to that question, I think that depends who you're talking to. With friends, it's no holds barred. And I don't know, what should I say? For example, I've got one or two politicians' friends who date back to university days, and we will sit round in the pub or dinner, whatever it is, and the politicians will say things that certainly aren't in line with their party views, and I will say things that I certainly could never say on the air. But that's because we trust each other. You know, friendship really matters in that way. But if I was in a group who I didn't know particularly well, I would be a bit careful. Yeah. I mean, for example, when you do books, you quite often get invited to talk at literary festivals. And I am a little bit wary. It's important to be as honest as you can, otherwise why on earth are you up there talking? But I am a little bit careful about saying what I feel strongly about in those circumstances. So it really is a question of judging the forum, I think, that you're in, and especially whether you trust the people that you're speaking to.
Too many of us are living in a bubble and not hearing both sides of the world's important stories. It's time for a more rounded perspective. It's time to discover Premier Christianity. Balanced, confident, relevant, faith-filled. Discover fresh biblical perspectives as we bring you wide-ranging stories that impact the church. Discover the go-to source for Christian news. Subscribe at premierchristianity.com. Now only £5 for 3 months.
There've been some high profile examples recently of BBC presenters who've left and worked for other media, and those presenters have spoken about how they've sort of felt liberated that they can finally give their personal views. But it does strike me as, I think, very admirable that we can have those who say, no, I want to be impartial as a public service. And even though you might be tempted to perhaps give more away, I think there is something very helpful for society as a whole, actually, to have people who say, I'm going to just be a bit more careful and restrictive in order to be as fair as I possibly can.
I think that's right. I mean, I did once break the rule very badly, and I got into trouble for it, which was after I had been on a reporting tour in Sarajevo during the siege in the early 1990s. It was a very traumatic experience, and I was so horrified by what I'd seen that I came out and I wrote a piece in The Telegraph, I think it was, arguing that it was the duty of Western nations, including Britain, to do something about this in military terms and stop it happening. As it happens, the government actually agreed 6 months later and did exactly that. But at the time, it was a very controversial thing to say, and I shouldn't have done it. And I got bawled out by my boss, and I got bawled out by several politicians. The funny thing is that reflecting back, I'm pleased that I still had the capacity to be really angry about something, because I think that sense of passion is also important for journalists. So I have broken the rules once, but I wouldn't do that now. And I do think the impartiality thing is, as you say, hugely important. And you can't really do your job without it. It was a bit different then. I was a relatively young reporter. I wasn't a kind of anchor figure. But thinking back, I do have this other odd thing in the sense I'm quite pleased I was able to be angry enough about clear sort of injustice to want to do something about it. But I've now learned, and I wouldn't do it again.
And I think that also raises a really interesting point about us as human beings having emotions. And actually, I think often our audiences who listen to us, they don't want a completely detached, unemotional report necessarily. And clearly you had an emotional reaction to seeing conflict, and that did something in you. And you know, do we sometimes need to be a little bit less wooden as broadcasters and show our emotions, where clearly it's human beings and it is awful scenes, and you feel that human urge to have to do something to stop it?
Well, how could anyone not feel emotional about events in recent days in Israel and Gaza? I mean, you wouldn't be human if you didn't feel emotion in those circumstances. That said, there is also a duty, I think, on broadcasters to control that emotion so that it's a kind of source of energy, if you like. And not to let it get in the way of your basic duty, which is to tell people what's happened. And I think I have to say, I think some of the BBC people have been absolutely brilliant at finding that balance between showing their humanity and responding as humans to the really awful things they've seen, at the same time as remaining professional and transmitting information in a balanced and fair way, and also framing it in the context, the political context that you need to have in mind. So that is a tricky balance to maintain, but I think it's possible. And the best correspondents do it all the time.
Now, you've obviously interviewed many hundreds of people over the years, and I imagine in putting together this book, you were able to revisit some of those conversations. But what are the most memorable people you've met or interviews you've done with people who perhaps just stand out for really positive reasons that you felt you had a connection with or had something important to offer?
Well, it's people often ask me something along those lines. I'm just having a look at the book, actually. And I mean, there are a few people. Desmond Tutu, you know, he always filled the room with joy, and you came away from the interview feeling how privileged it was to meet somebody so inspiring. Clearly alive with the best of Christianity and the best of the Christian spirit. There have been other occasions, I suppose, when I've talked to people like that and then found I've been disappointed. I mean, I have complicated feelings now about Cardinal Hume, who was the abbot at Ampleforth when I was a boy there, and who I admired. You're a bit young to remember him, but he was an extraordinarily powerful moral voice in British society, and he had this kind of saintly aura. You felt you were in the presence of somebody who was comfortable talking to God, which is a very unusual quality. And I actually did the last interview he did before he died. He died of cancer. There was a firebomb attack on a gay pub in Soho, and Hume came onto the Today programme, knowing that lots of people might want to ask him difficult questions about the Catholic Church's view of gay relationships, and was absolutely clear, very courageously, in condemning what had been done. And it was particularly moving because you could hear his voice, which was beginning to lose its power as the cancer was quite advanced by then. So he was a bit of a hero of mine. And yet, when the child abuse inquiry into what happened at Ampleforth came out, it is apparent that he covered up for an abusing priest and sent them off to a parish and didn't report them to the police. And that leaves you with a very sort of unsettled feeling. You know, what your hero has feet of clay. It's very difficult, that, and I find that very upsetting. It's also true, and this is perhaps more uplifting, that very often some of the most engaging and encouraging interviews are with ordinary people who've been through extraordinary events. And in the context, since we've talked a bit about the Middle East, I went and did a program on the anniversary of the foundation of the State of Israel, which, of course, by Palestinians is regarded as the Nakba, the disaster. And we talked to a group of mothers, Palestinians from Gaza, Israeli mothers from southern Israel, where so much is happening at the moment, all of whom had lost family members because of the conflict, and had decided to form a kind of mutual support group and share what they'd been through with each other as a way of building links which, you know, transcended the divisions between the two societies. And that was, you know, none of them are famous. I don't think I can, I mean, they're in the book, but I can't remember their names. But they were so inspiring.
What's been the best day of your career, and what's been the worst?
The best? Oh, gosh, I don't know. There's so many days. In a funny sort of way, I'm not sure that best and worst as a journalist really are the right terms to use, because the joy of it, as I said earlier, the great privilege is being there where history is being made. And quite often the history is bad stuff. I gave the example of Sarajevo, which I still look back on as one of the most intense experiences of my life and of my career, but it was dreadful. I mean, so it was best in the sense of being a very intense experience, but worst, one of the worst in terms of what I was seeing. It's also, if you've been around as long as I have, you find that history can change your judgment about things. So immediately after the Taliban fell, after 9/11 and the Northern Alliance, American help, moved into Kabul, I managed to get down to Kabul from Pakistan with a group of journalists, and we broadcast the Today program live from our hotel bank balcony in Kabul, with a sort of the cool winds of the Hindu Kush coming down and this great sense of liberation and excitement about what it was going to mean, particularly for women. Was this going to be a new Afghanistan? Which I would have said was one of the, you know, was definitely a high point of my career. But then 20 years later, I'm sitting doing The World at One in London and watching the whole thing fall apart as the British and the Americans and everyone else withdrew, and the Taliban moved back in. So so that turns it into one of the worst days. You know what I mean? It's quite difficult to talk about things being good and bad in that way. Does that make sense? I'm slightly weaseling out of sort of owning up to what was wonderful. And what
yes, it partially makes sense. I completely take the point that you're right. As journalists, it's often the really awful moments in life that we're covering, and there is this strange conflict, isn't there? Because on the one hand, professionally, you feel this great sense of honor and privilege. You're there at the moment history is being made, and you know. Frankly, if we're speaking really, really honestly, it's kind of good for your career, you know, to be at the biggest news story of the day. But then, of course, on a human level, as you say, there could be tragedy or war or death. Yeah. And those things, of course, on a human level, you don't celebrate. I suppose my question, though, was more personal for you. You know, have there been particularly great days in the office or bad days in the office where personally for you, there's been high points and low points?
Oh, yeah, well, I mean, my worst day in the office was being fired from the Today programme. I'll be quite frank about that in public beforehand. And worse than that, hearing about it from a journalist and not from my boss. But there's a great quote from St. Augustine that I try and remember whenever I feel cross about that, which is that feeling resentment is like drinking poison and hoping the other person will die. Which is always good for a quote, St. Augustine, and I think that's true. So I don't dwell on it too much because I think it's corrosive to, you know, feel that you've been hard done by in that way.
Yes, and it strikes absolutely to the heart of Christian faith to forgive. And I was thinking of that when you said the most inspirational people you've met are often the normal people. Who have extraordinary things happen to them. And I'm sure you and I can both think of people we've interviewed who, you know, have chosen often as Christians or people of other faith have chosen to forgive in the most unimaginable of circumstances. But you know, using that example of being, as you said, being fired from the Today program, how do you forgive as a Christian? Is that a process? How would you explain that?
Well, before I claim heroic powers of forgiveness, one thing that was a mitigating factor was the enormous support I got from people complaining to the BBC about what was being done, and also actually from my wonderful children who started up a campaign Facebook group to try and get my job back. So there were lots of, you know, when something like that happens in a very public way, a lot of people pile in if they are fond of you, support you, and you know, in what's really a very heartwarming way. But I think that, I mean, I don't quote that St. Augustine idea in a frivolous way. I think it's absolutely true that if you allow yourself to be consumed with anger and resentment, you will frankly have a miserable time. Naturally, I'm cheerful about life. Perhaps because I've been very privileged and things by and large have always turned out well for me. I kind of have an expectation of that things will continue to do so. And I certainly have forgotten it, but you just, you know, goodness me, it's more than 10 years ago now, if I woke up every morning feeling really cross and hit the table, I'd be a miserable old sod, really, wouldn't I? But it's life's too short. I mean, there are cases. One of the cases in the book is a couple whose daughter was working for one of the Christian charities teaching in what was then Rhodesia, and she was murdered by a group of guerrillas, and they're interviewed, and they sound amazingly and deeply Christian in their forgiveness. And that's a rather more difficult thing to do, you know, forgiving the loss of a child, the killing of a child, and worrying too much about losing your job.
Yes, it certainly puts things into perspective. What do you think the future holds for you? You've done a number of different positions at the BBC. Is that you sort of set for life? You're a BBC man. Do you have any particular aspirations to work on other shows or other projects that you're looking forward to doing in the future?
I like writing, and I found that I spend more and more of my time doing books now. My level of BBC work is actually quite appealing, really. I mean, I do the Sunday programme, not every Sunday, thank goodness. And I'm doing The World at One tomorrow, which is a very enjoyable show. I'm doing at the moment an analysis about the challenges facing the French political system at the moment. So I've actually got quite a nice spread of things. And it gives me space to think about books. I've got another idea I'm kind of working up a bit, but they take a bit of time to. The gestation of a book is a bit like a gestation of an elephant. You know, it takes time and it can't be rushed. And I like having a little space in my life to do that. So I've had some very good sort of formal positions in broadcasting. I mean, I, you know, really enjoyed being Washington correspondent, Channel 4 News, diplomatic editor for ITN, Paris correspondent for the BBC, a newsreader for a long time, 10 years on the Today programme, the Sunday programme. But I don't really care about the positions anymore. I still enjoy doing it. I'm quite happy like that. I think I'm probably too old to have vast ambitions. Business as usual, really. I keep chuntering on it for as long as people will read my books and, you know, listen to me on the air.
I was doing some reading about you a few moments ago, and you were described in one place as an expert on the Roman Catholic Church.
Oh, yeah.
Do you feel like you're an expert on the Roman Catholic Church?
Well, when I was a trainee at ITN back in the early 1980s, one of my first jobs was to write briefing notes on things like transubstantiation for the reporters and presenters in the run-up to John Paul II's papal visit in 1982. So I've kept a kind of sideline of Catholic interest going over the years. So I'm not sure I call myself an expert, but I have a sort of, I don't know, a reasonable running knowledge of it, and I do keep that up, because obviously for Sunday it's very important.
Yes,
and it's fun because it means I get sent to do papal conclaves, which are really, really enjoyable. You know, lovely place, great lunches, huge drama, that wonderful setting in St. Peter's Square. There's nothing like it, really.
Well, I would very much appreciate your take on one of many issues facing the Catholic Church. And I suppose there's a specific question around Pope Francis and one of the issues, which is same-sex blessings. But I think there's a broader question here about the Pope, because in recent weeks, there has been this suggestion that Pope Francis is indicating the Catholic Church could move towards blessing same-sex relationships. Yeah. But I do think there's a wider question there as well, which is how we English speakers understand Pope Francis. I've seen people argue before that some of the Pope's comments can be lost in translation, or even that he has more of a pastoral approach that doesn't always fit the categories of the kind of theologians, if I could put it that way. But could I get your view on that, on, first of all, whether Pope Francis is likely to allow same-sex couples to be blessed, but also more widely, how we should understand and interpret the Pope's words, and if he is being misunderstood by some parts of the media, perhaps?
Well, on the first point, I don't honestly know. The only thing I would suggest is it's worth going back and looking at the way he's managed some of these big questions of reform. And he's always been careful not to run ahead of the church. You know, he's floated these ideas, but he hasn't gone through with them if he doesn't feel that he's got the support of the church as a whole. And an example of that, I suppose, would be the summit on the Amazon. I don't know whether you remember this, but because there's very few priests in the Amazon, it was suggested that they might start to ordain married men to minister to Catholics in the Amazon region. And of course, the suggestion following that was that once you've done it for one group of Catholic priests, you then introduce married ordination of married men across the world. Now, there was a lot of, you know, tension about that in the run-up to the summit on the Amazon. And in the end, it didn't happen because the support for it just wasn't there. And when he sees that, he doesn't push things. I mean, similarly with women deacons, you probably remember there's two commissions have met to discuss question whether women could be deacons edging into the field of female ordination hasn't happened. So he introduces these ideas, but he doesn't force them through. In terms of your broader question about the way we interpret him, there's that very striking phrase about a culture of encounter. The idea that you don't abandon church teaching, but that when you meet people and you hear their stories, it changes the way you approach a question. And you know, you say, is he a pastor? And I think that's part of being a pastor. And I think that's the way to interpret what he says. It doesn't mean we really know where it's going, but it gives you an indication of the kind of doors that he's nudging open, if you like. Mm. And reforming something like the Catholic Church is not something any one man can do. And I think a lot of what he's done is preparing for a kind of long conversation about some of these questions and trying to detoxify them, if you like. So that's my interpretation of the way to respond to what he says, which is, I mean, it's, we like to talk in political terms, don't we? Are you for or anti-hanging? Or, you know, what do you make of HS2 or whatever it is? And I don't think you can fit him into his political categories. I think he is a traditional Catholic in lots of ways, but because of his pastoral experience in Latin America, he allows himself to be influenced by his encounters, by the stories of real people that he's heard, and that yes. informs his decision making process.
Yes, and it strikes me that they are the most interesting people, the people you can't quite put in a neat category or box, and who transcend some of these questions. I mean, dare I even mention in the same sentence that Jesus could be a bit like that, with people trying to catch him out, are you this or are you that? And sort of trying, it seems at times, to walk this kind of middle way where he couldn't quite be pigeonholed. And I wonder if there's something of that, not just in Pope Francis, but in the most interesting people that we meet, that they can't be neatly categorized or boxed.
I think that's absolutely right. I think that's absolutely right. And the great contrast is with his immediate predecessor, Benedict the 16th, who I did actually meet and interview when he was the head of the Church's theological watchdog. And it's interesting because he, in complete contrast to his sort of public image, he was utterly charming, very gentle, very polite and warm. But once we started doing the interview, you realize you were in the presence of a formidable intellect, because every question came back, you know, six over the boundaries with interest and all that. But he was quite, well, he clearly was quite rigid in his thinking. You know, he absolutely honed on certain areas of traditional Catholic belief and said, no change there, forget it. And Francis is, although he, as I say, I think in some ways he's quite an old-fashioned Catholic, but he's obviously open to hearing the voice of the Church, of the people of God, I suppose, is one way of putting it.
Absolutely. Well, Edward, it's been fascinating talk. I wish we had more time, but you do have to now dash off to something far more important than this interview. Congratulations on just becoming a grandfather for the third time, I think, just in
Thank
the,
you
in
very
the past
much,
few hours.
Yeah. Times it happens, it's always such a thrill.
Well, please enjoy being with your family, and thank you so much for spending a bit of time with us here at Premier Christian Radio. It's been a pleasure.
Very nice to talk to you. Thank you.
You've been listening to The Profile in association with Premier Christianity Magazine.
If you have enjoyed this interview, we would love it if you could give us a quick rating and a review wherever you're currently listening to this podcast from. It helps other people to discover the show, and it will just take you 2 seconds. So a rating and a review would be amazing, and we would massively appreciate it. That's it for now. We'll see you same time, same place next week for another great episode of The Profile coming up soon. Take care.
Kick off summer with Memorial Day savings at Lowe's. Right now, get five Scotts Naturescapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. Plus, get up to 40% off select major appliances and save an extra $50 on every $500 you spend on select major appliances $396 or more. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 5/28. Mulch offer excludes Alaska and Hawaii. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.